Okay, good morning.
So
in assignment three solutions, I've just pasted all the answers that we got for the last question. It's kind of an interesting list. I don't know quite what to make of it.
Because I was hoping for a little more like consensus or something, but there's 34 items on it. And some are really kind of Linux stuff. It's like, okay.
What was the most interesting one you got?
The biology portion, Unix permissions, the description of multidimensional arrays.
It's an array with arrays.
Yeah, I guess maybe in talking about the system call modeling, I guess maybe, but that was. Anyway, there's a web. Some of them are really broad, like firewalls and web security, and how signatures work. And we've covered a lot of topics. That's one thing this kind of reinforced to me is that, yeah, we've covered a lot of ground, and I don't. I think a lot of the details of specific things, I expect you to be able to go out and research as you need, because there are so many details. And in fact, I have made it a point not to focus too much on the specific details, because I don't think that's the point when you're talking about security. And because the details to break any given security policy are almost always esoterically complex. I mean, it's just these lots of little mechanisms. But if you think about security as a problem, you realize that most of the time you don't care about those things. I mean, yes, if you're having to patch a specific vulnerability, you have to know those details. But the only one who really understand those details are typically the ones who created the exploit code and hopefully the ones developing the application. I actually say hopefully the one developing the application, because so many times when there are vulnerability reports, the developers will go, no one could make that happen. My program can't be exploited that way. That wouldn't work. You know, they have all these excuses for saying how their code is correct. And it isn't. And even when you show it to them, you go like, I don't know. And sometimes if you show them the exploit and they try fixing it, they block that specific exploit, but they don't fix the vulnerability. And so the security researcher goes, oh, you didn't fix the problem. See, look, this exploit works. I tried explaining it to you, and you don't understand. So I can't teach you at that level. And if you become a security researcher, you'll start trying to understand systems at that level. But even then, you'll only understand pieces, parts. You won't understand all of it. But that's not what the problem, that's not what this class is about. It's about the game and about kind of more the landscape, what you're trying, the way the attackers work, the way defenders work, strategies, and understanding how us as software developers have a part to play in that, no matter what. So before I talk about anything, I mean, I could spend today reviewing various topics. On Monday, I was planning on going through the solutions for assignment four and then reviewing various topics and stuff. I could do that today, but I kind of want to know if people have, like, from that list or other things in your mind, is there things that you're kind of like, what about that?
So it didn't exactly fit in that question, so I answered with something else. It's not really related to the material, but I have a very hard time determining the scope of the answer you're looking for in the assignments.
Mm.
And I'll tend to, like an example was the certificates and stuff like that. I just sort of glossed over public-private key because I took a cryptography course last semester. We really went into details, and I didn't feel it was as relevant to the question.
Right.
It was more about certificate chain, the signing, the authorities, and
right.
All that.
And you got partial marks.
And I got partial marks. So it's like it's little details like that that I'm having.
So I think the big thing to understand when answering the questions is if you think you can Google the answer, you're wrong. If it looks like something someone has written on another page, it's probably not what I'm looking for. It may be based on that. I'm not looking for long answers most of the time. What I'm looking for is an answer to the question. So
let me be concrete what I mean by that. So let's actually talk about assignment 4. That's kind of a little more relevant to what you're having to do right now. So, like, for example, question 1. So one thing to know is, like, how much of an example I'm looking for is based on how many points it's worth. So question 1 is, you know, question 1 through 4 are all 1-point questions. So I'm expecting something a little, you know, shorter for that. If it's a 2-point question, then you're going like, okay, what am I doing to justify 2 points? You know, but here, when code runs in a sandbox environment, does it refer to a specific security technology? Explain briefly. So I don't want to just tell you the answer right now, but if you look back and when I talked about sandboxing, I had some very specific comments about what I meant by a security technology. When I've looked at some of these, the answers that have gotten points off and things, what I've noticed often is people look at the question, Google for an answer, find some text online that seems to answer it, and then paraphrase that in their answer. And it's like, and it's kind of like, well, that's, I mean, it always has part of the answer. That's a good way to get partial marks. Like, for example, with this, if you were to Google sandbox environment or sandboxing, you will find lots of pages about lots of different technologies and lots of different contexts. Almost certainly, if you include that in your answer, it won't be right, because almost all of those things aren't talking about sandboxing as a general concept. They're talking about specific sandboxing technologies. So let's say number 5. You know, number 5, I've got all these questions about this Firefox extension that I've asked you about. And like the, things like, what, you know, 1 and 2, A and B are pretty straightforward questions, but C, why does it need these permissions? It's like, I mean, that I'm looking for a very direct answer. It's like, well, why does it need those permissions? If you took those away, I mean, what's the reason for those permissions? And you can get kind of more granular, you can get more, you know, or more broad, but it's a 1-point question. So I'm looking really, do you understand what the permissions are about? Why are they there? And then, is it possible for the extension to perform actions unrelated to its purpose with these permissions? Explain briefly. There's like, well, if it can do something else, explain it. So probably an easy way to explain it is by giving an example of something it can do that wouldn't be in scope. Or if it turns out it can't do anything else, you want to explain why that's the case. You know, so, but now in contrast, like question 7 is worth 8 points. Now question 7 is define whitelist, blacklist, anomaly detection, virtualization. So at least I'm looking for a definition of all of those. And then I'm looking for an example for each. But again there, if you go and Google those terms and say, oh, a whitelist is this, and a blacklist is this, and you look at that, and it's like, none of those definitions you'll find are probably canonical. I'm not saying my definition necessarily canonical either. I don't need you to repeat the definition that I said. I want you, though, to show that you have a coherent understanding of what a whitelist is in a very broad conceptualization of the term. Like, if you just talk to me about a definition that I apply to whitelists in an antivirus context, and I go, access control policies can be considered a kind of whitelist. Does that fit under your definition? And most, you know, people will kind of go, you know, most definition go, access control is completely different from whitelist. Whitelist is used to whitelist, you know, these network things, and we know here, you know, that's an access control policy. I mean, it's just, you get into all these stupid ways people try to explain things, making differences where there aren't differences. So
I don't mind if you don't have a definition that isn't exactly mine. I do mind if you go and just say, oh, this is what they said, and not really say, does this make sense? Especially in the context of that question where it's like, okay, we're talking about four specific strategies and saying most security technologies fit into these, so you know, talk about that level of granularity. So,
this assignment in particular is pretty straightforward.
Okay. The questions in assignment three were a little, were definitely more vague. And so I tried to make them more specific here. But as far as, I was really looking for, what's the key point? I mean, generally each point you can get at with a couple of sentences, you know, 2 to 3 sentences. If you're having to give a lot of text, you're probably talking around the question. And often what that happens there is that you don't actually understand the concept. Like there's, you know, now sometimes people answer because it's too, you know, they just say it too little. So maybe if you're just saying one sentence, that may not be quite enough. But I agree. It's you know, sometimes these things, the interpretation's there, but that's part of the testing. I could make this multiple choice, and it would be very unambiguous what answer it would be. But it wouldn't be that good of a test of what you actually understand. Anyway, and again, if you feel like you misanswered, that you didn't get enough points and that you deserve more after looking at solutions, and it makes sense, I'm happy to say, oh, I didn't think of it that way, and I'm happy to give points back if you feel like it's unfair, but think of it this way. If you're giving an elevator answer to someone about a concept, can you, like someone says, oh, so what is really intrusion detection? Or what is these? I mean, can you explain it quickly in a nice, tight way? That's what it means to really understand something, is you can really kind of say, oh, this is the essence of it. And yes, it may gloss over some little things and maybe I'll poke at it, but you get the basic gist of it quickly. Other specific questions?
So are you saying we should like abstract definitions like beyond just like a security kind of understanding of the word in itself? So you could explain intrusion detection from the context of like a literal like security guard in a building detecting intruder walking in the building. Like is that what you're saying would be a better definition than to actually explain intrusion detection from a specific computer security standpoint?
Yeah, actually, yes. Exactly.
Okay, cool.
I mean, it's like, because let's say, you know, what are you trying to do? Intrusion detection, you're trying to detect unauthorized access to a system or network, you know, a system of some kind. And so it is, you know, providing the functional equivalent to a guard. I mean, if you did do the metaphor thing, you would have to also ground it out and say, well, what does that actually mean in technical terms? And maybe give a little bit of saying, well, there are these different strategies or something, you know. But, yes, I mean, mostly, if you look online and you look at what definitions people give, even in textbooks or something, you look at it and you go like, that's, it's not that it's wrong, it's that it doesn't help you connect it with anything else. And so it doesn't show that you really, it tends to be more at the surface syntactic level as opposed to what the actual semantics of it is. And that's why, you know, if you're trying to answer using the answers from the web is certainly okay, and I'm not discouraging you from reading about things. It's just that if you're directly quoting or paraphrasing what you find in a search, you're doing it wrong. Because there's a reason I did not use a textbook for this class. Because, you know, I couldn't get quite the perspective I wanted to on the material. Now I could say I could write a book, but it's like some of these things actually, it's kind of hard to write down precisely because it's, you know, I'd say my understanding is always evolving. So every time I teach this class,
every time you think about these things, my understanding changes. So. Specific concepts, I mean, specific things. I mean, I could sit here and talk about access control and talk about intrusion detection, talk about cryptography. Because otherwise, I want to talk about network monitoring. This is a fun topic I haven't really talked about too much. I have a particular take on it. That you may or may not find interesting. So, when I say network monitoring, so what are we talking about? We're talking about having, so let's say we have an organization, you have a bunch of boxes in here, they're all connected, and then there's generally some sort of pipe, to the internet. And so, who's taking notes? So if you talk about this pipe, doing network monitoring, we often talk about network monitoring in, first off, a security context. So in security context, you're saying a network intrusion detection system, I want to know when the bad things happen. Or we talk about, from a system administration point of view, I want to know, what does an ISP have to do? It has to monitor connection, going, oh, look, this connection is getting too congested. Maybe we have to add additional capacity, especially if there's lots of the connection or something. So, or maybe you're trying to diagnose, oh, look, that machine is sending lots of bad traffic, or maybe it's misconfigured or something, or maybe there's a DNS problem. There's all kinds of things you can learn about a network by monitoring network traffic. Now, to a first approximation, network monitoring is becoming harder and harder and harder for one simple reason, right? Encryption. More and more protocols are being encrypted. I mean, of course, there's web traffic, which is being encrypted. All the move to TLS. Email is increasingly being encrypted.
Also, aren't they sort of trying to put everything on one port so that things aren't really differentiated the way they used to?
Well, the non-differentiation is due as much to the rise of the web and firewalls. Because we put in place firewalls to block remote RPC, people then said, we still want to communicate, have various protocols, programs run over the internet, so we're going to have all those run over HTTP, and so, we do have things like web application firewalls, and I think which kind of filter it, but I'm more thinking of the other protocols that have always been there are now also being encrypted. Like, for example, now, DNS. DNS used to be this protocol that was just wide open, and there was work on trying to guarantee the authenticity and integrity of it using DNSSEC. And you can think of DNSSEC as basically just signed DNS records. Now, how do you have signed DNS records so they fit in appropriately small packets and you don't hurt performance and all these things? That's a bit of an issue. But DNSSEC mostly deals with that. But now, particularly over the past few years, many people went, if we leave DNS in the clear, then it can be monitored and manipulated. I mean, just if anything, the monitoring, I know what other machines you talk to. Now, of course, you go, but don't you know that already because I see my IP level traffic? And I kind of have to, unless you're doing onion routing, which is where you bounce your packets all over the internet, you see where the packets are going. But why might an IP address not necessarily tell you so much as opposed to DNS? There's one big piece of this that kind of changed all this.
The cloud.
What?
Huh?
The cloud flare.
Yeah, cloud flare and stuff. So there's content distribution networks. There's people using, you know, how many IP addresses could Netflix use? You know, how many different systems can be, you know, sending stuff? Google the same way. I mean, the number of machines now that can be part of a given service can be increasingly large. And those same IP addresses can be used for different services from different providers, especially if you're talking about content distribution networks. So unless you look at the DNS level, you actually don't know what's happening. So monitoring DNS is a very powerful way of figuring out what is happening on the network. People are going, that's kind of bad. So now there's efforts to tunnel DNS over TLS. And in fact, there's now some folks saying, oh, you can, you know, support, you know, you can have your DNS all protected. And other people are saying, well, maybe you shouldn't do that. But anyway, just network monitoring is a very general concept. And so there's this idea that you may be able to implement a lot of control in the network because we can't control the endpoints. If you're talking about someone who's administering a network. But that assumption is increasingly challenged because of all the encryption that's happening in the network. But stepping back, let's assume this isn't a problem. Let's just assume that all the stuff in the network is in the clear. There's nothing encrypted. How, so here I've got two questions for you. How do you secure network, you know, secure what's happening in terms of like finding, not so much preventing eavesdropping attacks, because of course, well, now we've assumed no encryption, so eavesdropping is trivial, but more, how do we find out bad things that are happening? So how do I find the bad stuff? But there's a much more profound question, which is related to this, is how do I understand? What the network is doing. Because that's really what we want to do. We don't want to just, yes, we want to secure it, but if you're talking about a system administrator, yes, they want to care about security, but they want to know what's going on in their network because they're responsible for it. So you might say, wait a second. Okay, you're going to secure it, you want to understand it and stuff. Okay, but actually, that doesn't matter because it's all going to be encrypted anyway. But actually, this assumption of there not being encryption is actually a valid one for certain classes of network. Enterprises. Most of the time, enterprises have measures put in place so they can monitor all encrypted traffic. And the reason why is because they often are legally obligated to. Example, financial institutions, they're concerned about things like insider trading. Or, you know, so they have regulatory compliance issues, so they have to monitor communications. So they have to be able to scan emails, they have to be able to scan network traffic, they have to be able to look at everything potentially. So they use various ways of either foregoing encryption, or they use encryption where they have monitoring boxes that have the keys to the encryption. So they can watch everything. So like, if I'm in an enterprise, how do I watch network traffic? I mean, how do I watch encrypted traffic? Let's say I want to decrypt every TLS session. How do I do that?
You get everybody's keys and you would just try them all?
No. So you want them, even if they're communicating with Google and running email, you want to watch it. You actually know how to do this already. Because I've already told you how trust is established.
Okay. You set up a man in the middle.
Instead of a man in the middle. So, okay, man in the middle. So you have a box here, sitting here watching all the traffic going out to Google or whatever. how are you going to keep the endpoints? How are you going to intercept the encryption, though? I mean, it's a man in the middle, so, you know, normally TLS is designed to prevent this. So how do you get around it?
Well, is it the same way, like, how an internet service provider will be able to tell that you've been communicating with, like, servers that are known for, like, poor behavior or something?
No, it's not that. They have a much more powerful technique.
Yeah. Well, D&D installs root certs on every machine.
The system administrators install certificates on the boxes.
And when you go to Facebook, it says, oh, signed by D&D.
Exactly. What's happening here is it's performing a man-in-the-middle attack and it can work because it terminates the TLS connections here and then starts a new TLS connection to here. And it can fake any website certificate because it has a root certificate installed in the browsers. And for any other communication, they can do that. So, if you're using a computing device provided by an employer or maintained by an employer, you should assume that they have the technical capability of monitoring anything that happens or any communication that happens. Because they typically have an agent installed in the system and they have ways to monitor all the network communication. So, for a significant class of folks on the internet, this is effectively the case. But even so, that actually, even if it all is in plain text, it doesn't necessarily solve this. Why?
Because, I don't know, highly distributed networks can be extremely complex. Like, as your network is increasingly more complex, there can be communication going on between.
Well, in highly distributed networks, certainly. But have you just looked at the network traffic any of your devices does? Like your phone, your laptop? Have you looked at it? I suggest you look at it. There's a reason I had that as an experience, because it's crazy complicated. It's crazy complicated. I mean, there's all kinds of network communication. Like, what is that? I mean, just look at the network communication for visiting a regular website. One website. Have you seen how many TCP/IP connections are potentially created by that? I mean, just look at the network monitoring tab. You just go like, whoosh. It's like, I just wanted to read the headlines on the newspaper.
Actually, one of mine, I was running Fiddler on my machine, and just idle, I was getting about a connection every 5-10 seconds.
Fiddler?
It's a HTTP packet.
Oh, that's a monitor. Okay.
Yeah, monitor.
Okay. And just idling.
Just idling, and I was getting stuff like a weather update for one of the tiles, a Microsoft Word checking in with my usage, Google Chrome self updating. Every 5 seconds, something was happening.
To understand the network like that, wouldn't you need to understand every single system that you potentially can communicate with on the outside beforehand? So
this is what I'm getting at, is that what does it mean to understand a network? I mean, networks are crazy complicated because it's not so much that the protocols are crazy complicated. I mean, there is complexity there, but that's not the issue. It's that the network's being used for all kinds of things. That you're right. How do you understand? Like, what does Google do on its network connections? I mean, they download a lot of code into your browser, and it's doing a lot of stuff. And it's not just Google. Everyone does this. Just a page with ads on it is running all kinds of crazy code. And that doesn't count all the background stuff that's running on a regular machine for doing all the, you know, checking in on updates or updating some state or doing. You start looking through it, and you're just going like, oh my God. So, understanding, my basic belief is that it's very hard, it's fundamentally hard to secure phenomena that you don't understand in some way. You have, in the sense of understand, what does that mean? What does understanding always mean? It really means you have a model. Or multiple models. You have something, it's not that you know all the details, but you have this view of the world in which things work. And you kind of say, well, does that fit my model or not? It's like, looking at the traffic coming in and out of Carleton, you probably have a model of like how cars work and how people's work and how they go, you know, how traffic patterns and like that. You go like, okay. And so if you just sort start seeing cars coming into campus and they come in and they stop for 5 seconds with no apparent reason for stopping and then just go, and they stop and they go, and it's like, why is it stopping there? There's no reason for it or something like that. But then you kind of realize, oh, you're looking at one angle. If you look at it from another angle, you see, oh, there's a person on the side dancing in like this really weird outfit. And so everyone's just sitting there looking at him. So that's why they stop. And they have a sign saying, stop and wave to me. So, oh, that's why they're doing that. So it's, you have a model. When things deviate from your model, you go like, what? And then you kind of go like, oh, I understand what's going on. So in principle, we would want to have something like that for your network. Going like, okay, you maybe I don't know all the details, but I have a model of how my network's working. And so I can then determine when things change. So any way you're going to model the system, how are you going to model this? How are you going to develop a model? One way to develop a model is for a human to sit there dumping packets all the time and inspecting it and trying to learn it. And that, some system administrators do that. It's not that efficient if they spend too much time doing that, but they may do it for certain classes of things. How else would you understand it? What strategy would you use?
Frequency.
So frequency, yes, but frequency of everything? I mean, what do you mean by, of which messages? I mean, every packet's potentially almost unique, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So the first thing for any modeling of phenomena, you've got to aggregate things. You have to aggregate the phenomena. You can't say all of it's there, especially if it's complicated. You've got to put it into some classes, and then say, that's the thing. And then you try understanding the, and then you look at the relationships. You aggregate, and then you look at, you know. You know, relationships among the aggregates. And if you see that, then you have some understanding. It's an approximate understanding, but understanding is always approximate. So what do you, what would you aggregate in a network?
The default behavior? Like,
well,
if you could find like a typical...
Typical along what axis? So you have to decide what are your... So I'm saying when you're understanding any phenomenon, you have to understand that you are aggregating it in some way. You are putting it into equivalence classes. And those equivalence classes that you have, you then say, okay, let's relate. Like, when you're seeing cars coming into, you know, I mean, I've aggregated right there. I'm talking about cars. I mean, I could have talked about SUVs versus trucks versus things, but, or I could have talked about the red ones versus the blue ones or something, you know? Or I could have talked about how many tires are coming in. You know, there's different ways of aggregating things. And like, if I was a tire manufacturer, I might care more about the tires than I do things. So it's also about the purpose.
Services having a lot of difficulty with the networks because they're trying to handle all the department's networks, but they don't know the domain of anybody, and each department has teams with their own little servers doing their own little shit.
So shared services is trying to manage a network of a bunch of services that they do not understand.
Yeah, and with every category of information possibly imaginable,
Yeah. And with every possible category, and they actually have requirements on what they need to do with it. It's not just like they want to secure it. You know, they need to provide quality assurance or something. I mean, there's, So why I'm kind of going down this path is that in networks, in modern networks in particular, the way you should aggregate traffic in a way that would allow you to understand what's going on is not straightforward. Because classically, the way we would aggregate network traffic is using IP headers and TCP headers, which basically means you look at the source port, you look at the destination port, you look at the source and destination port and IP address. Maybe direction. What's the five tuple? What's the fifth tuple? Source, IP address, destination IP address, source port, destination port, and I think maybe the direction? I'll show the fifth one. Anyway. Looking at that, and that be the way for you to understand traffic. You just look at, okay, what's the traffic going to this IP address? What's the traffic going to that IP address? And when in fact you have relatively few computers that you'd be interacting with, this would make sense. So, like, if your traffic was mostly, you know, before, I mean, people just had more local area networks, just enterprise level networks, and didn't really connect to other networks except for a few limited things, then, okay, they're just, you know, the connections that would be in here are kind of understandable. There are actually approaches for doing this known as where they just literally look, made a table of what are the allowed IP addresses and port connections. And that would be your model of how the network worked. Does that sound like a good way to describe modern networks? It's horrible. It's horrible for a couple of reasons. One is, the number of IP addresses associated with a given service can be enormous. And moreover, it's not constant. I mean, if you look at the list of just how many IP addresses your phone touches, it's kind of nuts. You might say, okay, maybe I can do some stuff at the DNS level. And that, in fact, is also a way of aggregating things. Let me just look at what DNS things people are accessing. But then what happens if people go below DNS and bypass it, which some protocols do? Or even the DNS traffic can be rather complicated. So the aggregates are not clear. And you might say, well, you know, well, how do enterprise networks traditionally deal with this? Is they block whole classes of traffic from leaving their network, except through special gateways. Like most locked-down enterprise networks, you cannot make arbitrary connections to the outside world. If you want to talk to the outside world, you're going through an application-specific proxy. It's like you want to send email, you're of course, when emails normally you go through an email server, you have to send and receive stuff. But if you want to access the web, you're going through the web firewall, and a web proxy, and if you try going without the web proxy, you're not talking to the web. So that means that now you instead have all of these connections going through one box and then going out to the world. So now you have a point of, you know, a point at which you restrict everything. Problem solved, right?
Most corporate enterprise-based networks have machines that you can just bring outside of the network anyway, right? Like if you have a laptop, you don't even need to connect to the VPN to just connect to the internet, connect to whatever network you want.
There are sometimes they do that, but and there's also networks where they actually don't try to lock down things on a network level because they go like, well, you know, random crap's going to be there anyway, so we'll some more lock down the services. You know, there's lots of different philosophies and things about that. But what I'm trying to say is, how do you understand what's going on? Let's just talk about the understanding. How are we going to aggregate it? And you might say, okay, now I've made the network connections between systems simpler, and maybe I could model them now with a classic IP address, you know, port tuple kind of view, because now it's just internal machines talking to each other or them talking to, you know, this gateway box. But have I really solved the problem? Not really. Because how much web traffic is going to be going in a modern network? I mean, just insane amounts of traffic of all kinds of things. Now,
You might be able to have policies where you say, well, we won't let you connect to Dropbox because we don't want you sharing files. But then you go, someone on a random server they've set up just sets up an application for sharing files. How are you going to restrict them using that? You could say, well, I'm not going to let you access most of the web. You can only access... I mean, let's think of our classic security strategies. Let's try to do it with a whitelist strategy. Your whitelist strategy is going to crap out really fast because how are you going to get a list of all the websites everyone in an organization might want to access? Good luck with that. And then, let's try blacklisting. Doesn't work for porn. Probably won't work for anything else. You're not going to be able to blacklist all. I mean, yeah, I'm not saying you can't get some major services off there that might reduce some of the noise. But the blacklist is limited in its effectiveness, especially for anyone who actually wants to get around it. Whitelist, too much work to maintain. Blacklist, big holes. So then, we say, well, you know, can we virtualize it? Well, we did virtualize it. That's kind of what this is. We have the point of control. That's how we were able to implement these policies in the first place. So what was the strategy I left? Anomaly detection. That doesn't work either. Why doesn't anomaly detection work? We're looking at the tail is too big. Weirdness abounds. There's always something, someone's visiting some new website. Someone's doing some new thing. Oh, look, there's a new meme. You know, I mean, there's always these things that keep popping up. I mean, and this is the, and this is a fundamental fact of network traffic, is perpetual novelty. It's always different. There's always something new happening. So that means that if you try just, you know, building a model of, okay, let me just look for weird traffic, you're always going to find weirdness. What you're going to do is you're going to find this, you know, this fat tail. I mean, yes, most things are common and that's kind of simple, but your anomaly rate will be very high because you'll always see weirdness. And you might say, well, maybe if I just care about security-relevant things, then this weirdness won't be so big. I don't know any way of doing that. It's just always really, there's just stuff happening. Because we use the network for all kinds of crazy things. And, you know, it's such a big world out there, and no one seems to be able to just completely shut themselves off from it. I mean, you can try, and then you just get pushback because people want to communicate and look up information. So this is hard to deal with. I mean, you know what happens if you cut this off? You say, well, okay, we're just going to make all that not allowed. Now you have to deal with people actively circumventing your security policies. Because now you've interfered with the primary purpose, the primary task. So, I'm screwed. Nothing to do? I don't think so. Because there's one strategy I haven't really talked about, which I really more thought about in this context than I did in any other, which is clustering. So, when I put about clustering in this context, what I'm really saying is I don't know the right aggregates I want to put together. So why don't I automatically aggregate traffic in some way? In a way that, basically, I want to
figure out what things are similar, what things are different. And if I can just have a simple way of figuring out how to cluster things, then maybe I can figure out what's new and not. So you can think of now, normally anomaly detection is like looking at, you're always looking at the aggregates. But what if I use clustering, I now will get a bunch of aggregates, and then I can kind of then do anomaly detection on the aggregates and say, am I seeing a new set of traffic that's similar to itself and not like the other things? Or has the relative proportions of these aggregates changed? So maybe, I mean, not to say there won't be weirdness, but the weirdness hopefully will be in a small number of aggregates. So I can say, okay, the stuff that doesn't look like everything else, okay, there's some amount of weird stuff, I don't really understand it, but it's at least this much. And you know, like, well, maybe if it gets huge or something, then you look at it, but it's kind of, that's the stuff I don't understand. So it's like, we all look at the world, we almost always have something of like, okay, that stuff I just don't really understand. And if it's just, okay, I don't understand it, but there's just a little bit of it, it's like people making comments that you're like, I don't know quite what you mean by that. If they just make those occasionally, it's okay. If they start constantly talking like that, then you go like, oh, okay, that's something I don't understand, I better go figure it out. Like there's some reference to some new thing. You go like, I don't know what you're talking about there. So you go look it up. But if you just do it once, you might just like let it pass in conversation. Because it's all implicitly about how often it happens. A little bit of weirdness is fine. A lot of it, a little more worrisome. So this is all very high level. I'm talking about clustering. It's like, but now you should go, how can you possibly do that? Because clustering, if you know anything about machine learning algorithms for clustering, it's all about looking at distances. And so you can think of it like, okay, where are the piles? Where have things kind of come together? And how do you determine where the pile, where the greater concentration of things? You look at distance metrics. And normally to calculate distance metrics, what algorithmic complexity are we talking about?
N squared.
So N squared on a very large aggregate of data, especially one that's constantly being generated, is essentially a non-starter. There is no way. You're only going to be able to do an algorithm that ran with linear time. Even n log n is probably too expensive. You got to be able to stream through this as it goes by and make your classifications. So classic clustering algorithms, out the window. Can't use them. Too expensive. But is there any kind of clustering you could do on network traffic that might be, what strategy for a clustering could you do on network traffic that might be fast enough and would be, give you some insight?
Maybe a sliding time window?
Certainly you're streaming through the data. So you probably want some sort of sliding window and you probably want some amount of state. Yes. But what your modeling strategy? Can you model? So it's going to be some amount of expense to build a model to figure out what sort of aggregates are going to be required. I mean, you probably can't get rid of like something n squared is, or at least expensive in some way at some point.
Could you distribute some of that workload across the network? Sort of like have machines build their own mini models and then you model the models?
You could. I wasn't really thinking of that, but that's a strategy that could work. But I mean, there you get into how much can you trust those machines to model their traffic, though. You get into trust issues. Not saying you couldn't, but that I'm looking for something that hopefully makes the problem simpler. And the way I thought of it simple is if you can. So there's always this thing of you have to. Build a model, and then check model. So you check, you build a model and you check it. So you know this is always classic machine learning. You know, you You build a model by looking at the statistical properties or whatever of something, some training data, and then you try testing out some other data, and then you see how well you did, and you go like, oh, well, I fit, I didn't fit, and I adjust my model. Normally, machine learning, these things are about the same in terms of how much time it takes. You kind of spend a lot of time building, you do checking, you build, you check, you kind of go through this. What if I could build a model quickly? Make this relatively quick, and then do the checking of the model, but still have the checking of the model basically be in linear time. Now, there's always a way I can make model building faster. What's the way? Look at less data. The less data you look at, the less expensive it is to build the model. So if I can just use a little bit of data to build my model, I can build the model relatively quickly. And then as long as that model is simple to check, then I can go through and just, you know, I can run it in linear time checking the model. That's just saying, does the model fit? Does it fit? Does it fit? And then I can, when I say, oh, it doesn't fit, then I can rebuild my model, adjust my model. But that's, you know, so you have to then say, well, how can I limit my sampling? Because that's really what we're talking about. I want to look at a sample of the data. How can I look at a sample of the data and still get all the get the phenomena?
You could use compression techniques like input value decomposition, where you just basically get rid of all the excess input features and stuff like that.
Well, I'm not talking about compressing. I'm talking about that we can't look at all the data. I'm saying that I've got to be able to select just a fraction of the data to look at.
There's some statistical way you can make use of hashing such that you're only picking portions of the data, like, you know, one out of every 1,000 pieces of the traffic coming through, and you're able to still build an accurate model of what's going on based off of that.
But what you're talking about there, you still would have to do some function on every packet. Know that they hash that way. I mean, to get a real speed up, I've got to be able to ignore bunches of packets. That's the only way to do this, because I have to look at like maybe a few thousand out of the millions, billions of packets going by in order to build my model if I want to be able to do this fast.
So just as a clarification, so you're saying it's not a dimension problem, it's mainly just you have too many data points.
I'm saying that I'm going to run an n-squared algorithm. If I'm going to run an n-squared algorithm, if I can make n small, it's fast. So I have to make n small.
In which case, wouldn't the data points you select have to be properly distributed?
Well, that's the question.
I was going to say you could use code vectors.
Except that takes time to generate.
See, that's the thing. So most of these things involve you looking at the data, and you can't even touch it.
Right, the thing with k-means and k-n-n is you have to look at every single data point. I'm sure we'd like to
unscrew. Not quite sure how to explain this, but if you build your model off the first small set of and then check it against everything, the first one that fails, you add that to your original set and you build based on that?
That's basically the idea, actually. But the key insight behind it, why you can get away with this, why you only have to look at some of the data, you basically just take the data in a small time window, use it to build a model, and then check it against a bunch of data, and then you know, kind of see, okay, then maybe make small adjustments as you go. But any adjustments you make are basically very quick things. And the reason you can do this, though, is this. You have to realize what you can model is the frequent stuff. You can't model the tail, so don't try. I don't need a representative, if I need a representative sampling of everything under the curve, I'm gonna need to look at a lot of packets. But if I'm content to just getting the high frequency ones, if they're highly frequent, I don't have to look at many of them. They're going to show up. So I just have to look at them. I just periodically have to look at, grab like, say, 10,000 packets or whatever, and then do my analysis on those, and then grab another 10,000, grab another 10,000. I mean, I just have to do these periodic things rather than looking at all of it as it goes by. I now just need an algorithm where I can have a model that can be checked, that can be run through, every packet can be run through it quickly in, linear time or better, and that I need a way of incrementally updating the model. Because I probably don't want to be doing some really expensive generation. Even with this, I want to be able to keep adjusting the model as it goes on to reflect what the traffic is.
Oh, I just forgot.
Okay.
So just to confirm, you're talking about taking a vertical time slice of everything and then analyzing that time slice, and then as soon as you get your computation up to speed, you restart on a new time slice?
So I'm saying that how would I understand, if I'm a human, trying to understand network traffic, how would I do it? I wouldn't look at 50 billion packets. I'd probably look at like several thousand maybe, try to aggregate them together to look at them, try to do some deeper analysis to find the patterns. Once I found particular patterns I thought were interesting, I would then make rules for looking for those patterns elsewhere in the traffic. And I'd see if that rule actually held and see what the statistics are, and then I might go, okay, let me look at some more traffic and see if there's some things I missed or something, or look, oh, here are some things that didn't match any of my rules, and so let me look at those.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the reason this works is because you're basing your model on the most frequent stuff.
Exactly.
Okay.
The model is only designed to capture things. I can only capture the commonalities. I'm not going to capture all the nuances.
And then if there is a new thing in that frequent thing, then you stochastically just update the model.
Right, and in fact, now you actually look at what your model looks like. If the structure of your model changes, you know that something significant is happening in your network. Like now, there's a new aggregate that appears. Oh wow, this aggregate has all of a sudden changed or something. Assuming there is some semantic quality to the aggregates. The aggregates are just kind of these random things that you can't associate more meaningful concepts. It's gonna be a real pain. But if these aggregates are actually more meaningful, then you have a chance of maybe understanding. But so you see, networks, so I'm just trying to, let me summarize my argument here before I start talking about specific algorithms and the representation, is to say, I can't understand all of network traffic. It's too complicated. What I might be able to understand is certain aggregates of traffic, maybe the relationships between them, but if I just manually specify those aggregates, I just do this beforehand, I'm not going to capture the richness of network traffic because the usage of network traffic keeps changing. And really, I want to be able to see how things change. So I need to have some automatic way of determining an appropriate aggregate. But I need it, and so that assumes that let's do clustering, but I can't do traditional clustering because it's way too much data. But if I just take a slight variation on the clustering where I do clustering, I have to build up my aggregates using a slow algorithm, but a slow algorithm on a small amount of data. And I can get away with this because, in fact, that small amount of data will still have relatively good statistics, because I'm only interested in the frequent things.
I think you still need to be careful of like the dimensionality of the data, because a lot of clustering algorithms, like, they start to fail if the data is like too highly dimensional and there's too many.
Oh, yeah. I'm going to describe a very specific clustering algorithm that gets around this. It's not perfect, but it's got some really interesting properties.
We were looking at this in sort of a... Are we still looking at it from an intrusion detection point of view, or is this more just a...
So this is more trying to just understand network traffic. And the reason I say understand network traffic is because there's a lot of... there's actually a lot of theorems about how well someone can hide... covert channels,
yeah,
is this entire area of, can I hide my stuff in benign things? And the fact is, if you're willing to compromise on your bandwidth, low bandwidth covert channels are everywhere. You can stick them in all kinds of places. There's always ways to make it so that you can't see it. So So if you start just trying to look at a high, you know, initially just looking for the really weird stuff that's happening, you're doomed. But if I can get a high level understanding of just how my network is really being used, I then can simplify my problem. Because now I can say, well, all this stuff looks kind of what I expect, but what's going on here? And if I, hopefully I can do this so that the thing that's kind of, you know, kind of outlier is now much reduced, I now might be able to apply other methods and say, okay, or at least, what is your purpose at the network? I would say your purpose of the network, ideally it would be great to fix everything, but fundamentally that's, it's a shared communications channel where anyone can put anything on it almost. You need to manage it. And the things you want to manage it for are things like preventing people from communicating, like denial of service attacks, traffic flooding. That's the sort of thing you actually really have to care about at a network level, because you have to deal with it at a network level. Now, someone executing a very specific attack on your web server or something like that, it's like, use a host-based solution for that. Program, you know, behavior. There's other ways of dealing with those kind of problems. I'm interested in, well, what you have to deal with on the network level. And I'm saying that if you can't deal with this problem, don't even try for this problem. So once you have a good a model of this, then you can start saying, now let's maybe we can dig in with more finer grain models, and then eventually maybe we can get to that. But we're not going to do this perfectly because it's always weird. We can't do the blacklist, we can't do the whitelist, we can't do anomaly detection, at least in a straightforward way. So manage your expectations. But we still can get at, I think, this understanding problem in a way that gets away from the static rules. Because the rules will always miss big chunks of the phenomenon. I mean, think about how a network looked when people started running BitTorrent, but BitTorrent started looking like HTTP. And so they're going like, whoa! There's all this web traffic on these weird ports going in this huge amount of volume, and what is this? And so what they do is they finally implemented rules, had boxes that did deep packet inspection, that went in there and found the patterns associated with BitTorrent traffic, and that's how they dealt with throttling peer-to-peer traffic. But now tomorrow, someone comes up with a new protocol for doing this, can't even see it. No. The only time they could do is go like, wow, my network usage has gone up, and it doesn't look like Netflix, and it doesn't look like BitTorrent, and what's that? And so now someone goes in there and digs and tries to see. But only if it shows up as a high level, like, whoa, the network usage has gone all crazy, will they even start looking. They don't know what's going on. And you might say for a commercial ISP, who cares, but for an enterprise, someone doing all kinds of new things on your network, that might actually matter. So, what is the classic way that we analyze a network packet? It is using IP addresses and ports. So if you look at a whole packet, what it's really saying is, IP addresses and ports are all offsets in a specific packet. A source, you know, source IP address will be right here at the beginning of the packet, then the destination IP address, and there's a port. So there's all these little places here. If you want to look at it, you just say, well, at this byte offset, you know, is the source IP address, this byte offset is the destination IP address. You just look at that. And that's the header and the first several bytes of the header, and the rest of it's the payload. So one way we could do these aggregates is just by doing substrings. So fixed length substrings are known as n-grams. And n-gram analysis has been used in lots of context. It turns out you can identify the language of a natural language document by looking at the distribution of n-grams. You take n being 2 or 3 or something, and just look at the frequency of those things, of a few letters and stuff, and that will identify the language. Because different languages have different patterns of n-grams. You can also even do this to characterize meaning sometimes. You have semantic analysis with n-grams. N-grams is not, however, what we want for this. Because if you looked at an n-gram, to find an n-gram, you'd have to scan every byte of the packet. So that, first of all, is not good, expensive. And second of all, it loses semantics. because the same bytes in one position versus another position mean very different things. The source IP address versus the destination IP address are only distinguished by their position inside the packet. So some work we did was saying instead of looking at p n-grams, look at p n-grams. So look at an n-gram at a fixed offset relative to the start of the packet. So you see, a source IP address is just a length 4 n-gram at a certain, you know, p, and a destination IP address is, again, is a different one. But since we have p, p can take on any value inside of the packet. So now you have a uniform way of representing bytes anywhere in the packet. So you can do, this gives you a way of actually doing deep packet inspection in a lightweight way. Because sometimes maybe like everyone's visiting the same web page. You know, and but maybe that same web page is being served from a content distribution network, so it's coming from lots of IP addresses. How would you find that web page? Maybe the page would be at a certain offset within the packet. You might go like, wait a second, wouldn't I expect jitter? Shouldn't it sometimes be like a little further or a little before or something like that? Yes. You could try to generalize the P and say maybe it's at a certain, you know, allow a little jitter or something like that, but it turns out in practice, you don't need to. Because computers are ridiculously consistent, even when we don't want them to be. Packets have certain structures, so patterns tend to show up in the same places all the time. So now our problem of building a model is now building a set of PN-grams that describes aggregates of traffic. And these PN-grams, so we need to find the right PN-grams, but then checking the PN-grams is easy because we don't even have to read the entire packet. We can just look at certain bytes in certain positions and check it. And this, in fact, is exactly what router hardware is designed to do. It doesn't read the whole packet. It doesn't examine it. It just looks at things in specific positions. That's what the routing infrastructure is for. Now you can just do this, you know, look at those few bytes somewhere else in the packet, and now you've got your PN-gram matched. So you've turned it now into a kind of sublinear problem, which can be parallelized, you know, in hardware. But this doesn't get to the problem of which PN-grams. So we said we have an aggregate of network traffic is a set of, you know, if this packet's matched this set of PN-grams, maybe it has those PN-grams or doesn't have these PN-grams, that's what corresponds to an aggregate. But how do I find them? I'm going to tell you a really stupid way of doing it, which works remarkably well. You might notice a theme with my research. So, how much time do I have? I think I'm getting near
10 minutes.
Okay, perfect. So, first step, start with all the traffic. And then, take this traffic, take a sample of it. In the sample, compute the frequency of all PN-grams. Computing the frequency of all PN-grams in general is very expensive, but if you just have it for a sample of packets, it's not that bad. From this full frequency distribution of packets, you know, PN-grams in packets, pick one with a frequency of roughly 50%. Pick one PN-gram, frequency of roughly 50%. And then you... Now we get two classes. We have one, no, yes, one with no. One that has the PN-gram, and one that doesn't have the PN-gram. Do this recursively. Pick another PN-gram, sample, yes, no. Another PN-gram, here, the no, yes, no. Just keep doing this until you get down to aggregates that are small enough, say 2% of your network traffic. That's all you do. And so what you'll do is you'll have a set, if you take this tree construction, you'll have a set of PN-grams, and each of these, you know, each of these nodes represents a PN-gram split. There's a PNgram here for here to split yes, no. This is a PNgram, yes, no. This is a PNgram, yes, no. And so the to describe a packet, you just, you know, it's like a path. I'm like, oh, it had this one, it didn't have this one. This is essentially a decision tree. It's a decision tree for PNgrams. And this, at the end, you'll have a layer where you'll have an aggregate of network traffic. You know, you have one aggregate here, because however many levels you want to go, like you want to divide it in, you know, you want 2%, so that means you get like, you know, 50 leaf nodes. How many aggregates do you want? It just depends on how far you want to go, parameter say. And you may say approximately 50%, you generally have to have a range, maybe it's like 40 to 60%. So, okay, frequency-based analysis of PNgrams. You get a bunch of clusters. These are gonna be random, right? These aggregates you get, and the sort of decision thing, the basis on which you choose, this is gonna be random, right? Because we just pick these PNgrams based on pure frequency. Why should there be any meaning associated with this? But there is. Turns out, what you get are things like at the high level, you get IP traffic versus non-IP. TCP goes over here, a non-TCP tracker. HTTP goes over here. SSH goes over here. I mean, it does all kinds of aggregating. It even does it sometimes for encrypted traffic, aggregating things up, because it knows weird things about it. Like, there's padding bytes in the packet. And so it puts a rule on the padding bytes. Most of the time when it does this, it doesn't do it based on ports and IP addresses. And in fact, it actually even works pretty well if you get rid of the headers. Because there's all this redundant information in the payload of the packets. And so it's this really weird thing. It's almost port-based classification, but it does other weird things, right? Web traffic on a non-standard port gets aggregated with web traffic on standard ports. And so you can see, oh wow, that's web traffic. And then traffic gets broken down, so sometimes like certain types of web, like, okay, yeah, this is web traffic, but web traffic going to this URL versus there, that'll get split up.
And so like leaf nodes that are like more closely, you know, like located near each other are traffic patterns that are
more similar, yes. Yeah. Exactly. So you'll get subtrees of related traffic. Like for example, like certain web traffic, like maybe the ACK packets might actually end up being a leaf separate from the other things, but they'll all be close together typically.
That's what you mean by, like, that's how the clusters basically
is
what you're saying.
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
So it's a subtree. So, now, how to exactly interpret this? I mean, you can label this tree with, like, port information, like trapping and label it with some IP address stuff and things. And you can do that. But the problem of understanding network traffic has been turned into the problem of understanding this tree. Which is still a bit of a human factors problem. I mean, I had a student do a dissertation on this, and yeah, it took a PhD to kind of like, you know, go through and analyze our traffic and kind of see, yes, this is in fact there. There's a UI problem of like how to do this, but this is a lot simpler problem, it should be, to represent this, to show this in a human understandable way than showing all the traffic. And now you might, of course, be like, well, what are all the nodes? Or what are all the nodes? Like, those are like the catch-all things. It's like, whatever things that didn't match your rules, that's your tail. Now you can look at your tail directly and just analyze that specifically for patterns, or look at it and all the weird things happening. You know, you can do all kinds of things with that. But you now know that has the overall usage of my network changed or not. So if you're curious about this and you want to read up on it, there's this entire project that it's a little. So, NetAddict, so the algorithm is approximate divisive hierarchical, approximate divisive hierarchical, yeah, but, so NetAddict. But the key idea is approximate divisive hierarchical clustering. And it's just one of these things that we, you know, it took a few, you know, if you look at the papers, there's a whole evolution in how we came up with this. I suggest reading Hijazi, is Abdurrahman Hijazi did his dissertation on this. Still not as appreciated work as I would like, but papers are on my website and things. It's like, it's just, it's wicked crazy like how the phenomena comes out. It's just like, really? And I think it says something very fundamental about the nature. I mean, the only way this can work is that network traffic has to have these power laws in it. You know, that Zipf's law is kind of our theory for how this can work. And why does network traffic follow Zipf's law? It's because of why we engineer things. It's like, because network traffic kind of looks like human traffic because it has this hierarchical structure. Why does it have a hierarchical structure? It's because we need to understand things, because we encapsulate things. And so.
I can't even think of how you'd try to get around. To fool that.
Well, exactly. Like, if you start using traffic, a lot of traffic, and doing things, it's going to find the pattern because it will find something either that, if it's random packets, there'll be nothing that'll match it, and so it will go into the unmatch. Otherwise, it'll go into, you know, some matching. I mean, you can't just put random data and fool this because you're actually modeling the normal stuff.
You could put jitter in your traffic, except it's not going to change the overall.
Anyway, I'm out of time. It's 8:25, 11:25. We'll see you on Monday. Good luck with the assignment. Post to Slack if you have questions.
In terms of one more...